Welcome to The Forum on 90.5 WCBE. Every week we bring you the conversations that shape Columbus, straight from the Columbus Metropolitan Club's Wednesday networking luncheons downtown. The Forum is where leaders, thinkers, and community voices like yours come together to tackle the issues that matter most to Central Ohio. Want to join us in person? Tickets and details about upcoming forums are available at columbusmetroclub.org. What did freedom mean for Black Americans asked to fight for their country in Vietnam while still being denied equality at home? Acclaimed author and Columbus native Will Haygood explores the lasting echoes of a war that exposed America's deepest contradictions. Joining us today, Will Haygood, journalist, professor, and author of the new bestseller, War Within a War, The Black Struggle in Vietnam and at Home. Your host is Algernon Marbley, U.S. District Judge with the Southern District of Ohio. Let's dive into this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, The War Within a War, Will Haygood on race, Vietnam, and America's reckoning.
Written another masterpiece, and I'm honored to be able to interview you about it. You said that this is your most important book, so let's get to it. Why did you choose to write this book about the Black soldiers' experience in Vietnam now, where the book's theme is the intersectionality between the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement in the U.S.?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Judge. Really wonderful to be here with you. He is the closest I will ever get to the ghost of Thurgood Marshall. I tend to write books that I would like to see in the bookstore when I walk into the bookstore and I don't see that book. Thus, I was waiting on a book to be written about East High School and the all-Black state championship teams. Basketball and baseball that they won in 1968, 1969 school year, and nobody wrote that book, so I simply put it on the back of my shoulders to write it. With the Vietnam book, I grew up here on North Fifth Street. Right across the street from me was a guy named Skip Dunn. I'd wave to him every morning, "Hey Skip, how you doing?" I was in the seventh grade, he was in high school. And he had taught me how to play softball, and he was just a great heroic figure to me. And one day Skip was gone, and I asked my sister, I hadn't seen him in 2-3 weeks, and she said, "Skip's gone to a place called Vietnam." He lived directly across the street from me, and I never saw him again because my family moved to the east side of town. And on the east side of town, in 1968, my mother moved there May 1st, 1968. Just a little less than a month after the April 4th, 1968 assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And so there were tanks, National Guards troops on the street chasing us little Black kids in this housing project. And I remember indistinctly my mother, every time I went to the store, she would write a note to the National Guard troops and it said, "Dear sir, please do not shoot my baby boy. He is simply going to the store to get a carton of milk." My mother, from Selma, Alabama, that's where she was born, so you can only imagine what was swirling through her mind. So as a kid, if you want to look at a split screen, I had saw not only Skip Dunn, but there were five other guys from my neighborhood who went off to Vietnam. And then I myself found myself as a little kid running from tanks and being scared out of my wits. And so I was introduced to the war within a war early.
Skip came back to you, though. You hadn't seen him for a while. Tell us about how he came back to you and how we can get to see him, if you will, again.
Yes. I spent 5 years on the book. And then about 4 months after it was handed in, I'm in bed in my home in Washington, D.C., and I wake up in the middle of the night and I say to myself, I should have interviewed Skip Dunn, my neighbor, for the book. Doggone it. And so the next morning, I hop out of bed and make a phone call, very determined to track down Skip Dunn. And a friend here in town tells me, "Will, I'm sorry to tell you, but Skip passed away. Skip is gone." And I was very sad at that moment and angry at myself that I hadn't thought to find Skip Dunn. And I asked my friend if he could give me a number to Skip's widow, and he did, and I called her, Mrs. Neva Dunn, and she knew who I was, and we start talking, and she keeps interrupting me and saying, "But please tell me, what was it like making that movie with Oprah Winfrey?" And so once I was able to get that out the way and fill her up with stories about Forrest Whitaker and Lenny Kravitz and Oprah, of course, and then we swerved back to Skip, and I told her I was very sorry that I wasn't able to interview Skip, and she said, "Will, he would have been so happy just to have gotten one line in your book, just his name, Will. It would have made him so happy." But anyway, I'm happy that the book is going to be coming out. Before I hung up, I said, "Mrs. Dunn, can you send me, for sentimental reasons, a picture of Skip Dunn?" And she said, "Oh, certainly, honey." And 2 days later, the photograph arrived in a Federal Express package, and I looked at it, and I was haunted, because that was my Skip Dunn in that photograph. That was him. That was the Skip I knew. That was the 18-year-old Skip Dunn. I was smart enough to call my editor in New York and say, "Look, I know the book is finished, and I'm happy it's finished, but there's a photograph that I'd like you to look at." I sent the photograph to my editor. He calls me back and says, "You put the Skip Dunn story in the acknowledgments of the book," meaning in the very back of the book. "You will need to write something up front in the book about this Skip Dunn character." And I said, "Oh, I don't want to. The book's finished. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. You know, it's like put it to bed, tie a ribbon around it. Let's get it in the bookstores." And so he said, no, we're going to extend the deadline a little bit. We're going to open the process back up for you to add some pages at the front of the book." And so I did. I sent that to him, and he said, "Me and the art designer has designed a new book jacket. We threw the old one away, and we have a new one." Ladies and gentlemen, Skip Dunn has come back, has come down from heaven. This is his picture on the cover of this book.
That's a great story. But into the substance of the book, you write about this war as being America's first fully integrated war. What did you mean by that?
Well, in World War I, the U.S. military did not want black troops. So those who wanted to fight went to New York City, hopped on a boat, and went to France, and knocked on the door of the French and said, "We're here to fight to defend our country." And the French said, "Well, why aren't you fighting over there with your units? Why haven't your units sailed over here? And why aren't you with them?" And the black soldiers said, "Our country doesn't want us, but we hope that you do." And the French embraced the black troops, and the black troops proved their heroism, because they came out of World War I with enough medals to fill half of this room. But it went on like that. In World War II, the units were segregated. In the Korean War, even though Harry Truman had desegregated the military in 1948, finally, some people said at the beginning of the Vietnam War, we need to integrate the troops or we might get our butt kicked. And of course, that is what happened in the Vietnam War. And it was the first time in this nation's history that we witnessed forced brotherhood. A white and a black had to fight together. There's a line in the book where I write, white couldn't survive without black, and black couldn't survive without white. And it took blood and guts and war for this country to get to that point. It took a war to have evidence of a brotherhood, of unity, because everybody wanted to get back home to mama. If you were white from Bexley or Upper Arlington or Grove City, and if you were with a guy who was black from the east side of Columbus, both of y'all wanted to get back home.
You know, in that same vein, you point out in the book that by 1965, blacks constituted 12% of the population. But the black soldier constituted 30% of the combat battalion troops. You also note that blacks reenlisted at a higher rate than whites. How do you gauge the black community's support based on your research for the Vietnam War?
Yes, it started out highly supportive because there was nothing more important in a black church than for the minister in 1958, 1961, 1962 to look out in the pews and see a Navy person or a Army soldier in their crisp uniform, or a Marine, or somebody from the Air Force. That said to the black community, we are finally being stitched into the American flag because we are being promoted in the military. We are wanted in the military. And we are proud to serve our nation. To go to the story of why were there so many blacks sent to the front lines, that worried President John F. Kennedy. When he saw those numbers, he looked at his staff, his all-white staff, his military and staff, and said, gentlemen, we had better be careful because this is going to be seen as a white man's war. And then Martin Luther King Jr. a couple years later said, doggone right, it's a white man's war in a black man's fight, because the black soldiers disproportionately were at the front lines, and it was at the front lines where you could have your head shot off easily and quickly. And so that was the US government saying that the black man is more expendable than the white man. Simple as that. The numbers don't lie. People like numbers. Numbers can be backed up by more numbers, but these were numbers, not fake news. Nobody in those front lines had the option of calling the draft board saying, well, my son has bone spurs. Nobody. Those cats on the front line did not have the option of that. And so, yeah, or ankle problems. They answered and they went and they died.
Yeah. You opened the book with a quote from one of America's greatest authors, James Baldwin, and I'm going to read it in part. A racist society can't but fight a racist war. This is the bitter truth. The assumptions acted on at home are also acted on abroad. And every American Negro knows this, for he was the first Viet Cong victim. We were bombed first. Why was this so significant to you that you would include that in the introduction to this important work?
When I was a reporter with the Boston Globe, I came into the office one morning, and the features editor called me into her office. I had only been at the paper for 4 weeks, and of course, sometimes when you get called into an office early in the morning and hardly anyone is in the newsroom, you think that you're about to be fired. And so she says, "Will, there is a writer at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst who has a new book out, and I would like you to go interview that writer." And I said, "Oh, great. Who is it?" And she's handing me the book, and she says, "It's James Baldwin. He has a collection of essays that are just being published." And I'm sitting there saying, "Damn, James Baldwin, wow. Boy, I got to get my stuff together. James Baldwin, wow." And so it was his essays. It was a 400-page book. I had 3 days to read it, which I did. Then I hopped the train to Amherst, and he was staying with a couple, and I got out of the taxi, and they said, "Will, we're expecting you. Jimmy is inside. He's upstairs. He'll be right down. Go on in." Jimmy, my man, James Baldwin, Jimmy. And I went upstairs. I mean, I went up the porch steps into the living room, and I heard these footsteps upstairs, and I said to myself, "Golly, Will Haygood from Columbus, Ohio, in the same house as James Baldwin. God, like, wow." And if you've seen any footage of him, you know he had this very jazzy way of talking. He smoked cigarettes, and he comes hopping down the steps, and he sees me, and he says, "Hey, baby, how you doing?" He's smoking a cigarette, and I stand up, and I say, "What an honor to meet you, Mr. Baldwin. I mean, what a real honor." He said, "Oh, cool, baby, thank you. So let's get it on." And the interview's going so well, so beautifully, that I silently say to myself, "When this is over, I'm going to ask Mr. Baldwin a personal question." And so I did. I said, "Mr. Baldwin, thank you for this interview. And I'd like to know, sir, if I can ask you a personal question." Now, mind you, I hadn't written a single book then. And he said, "Ah, sure, baby, what is it? Shoot." And I said, "Do you, Mr. Baldwin, think that I will someday be able to write books?" And he took a long drag as he was looking at me, and he said, "How the hell should I know that? I don't know who you are. It takes discipline, baby, to write books. What kind of question is that? You asking me if you can, who are you? I don't know you, man." And my face sunk, and he could see it. And he scooted his chair closer to mine, and he pointed at me, and he said, "But baby, I'll tell you what. Whatever you do in life, you must go the way your blood beats. Whatever you do in life, you must go the way your blood beats." I tell my students that to this day. So you ask me, Judge, why Baldwin at the beginning of the book? He's the epigram. He's on the very front page. Because when I came across that quote, I said to myself, like Skip Dunn, James Baldwin and Skip Dunn reached down from the heavens, tapped me on the shoulder, and said, "Write this book." That's what I fervently, spiritually feel.
And Will, just like Skip Dunn and Jimmy Baldwin, they're very proud of this 11th magnum opus. I can tell you that much.
Thank you.
You You point out as more than a bit of historical trivia that the first black soldiers arrived in Vietnam on March 7th, 1965, the same day as the march on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in your mother's Selma, Alabama, and that was also known as Bloody Sunday. Comment on that historical irony.
There were two fights going on. The fight for equality and respect on that bridge, As those people were walking across that bridge, black soldiers without full rights, because with the snap of a finger, this nation did not change with the 1964 Civil Rights Act or the 1965 Civil Rights Act or 1968 Civil Rights Act. That was the Fair Housing Bill. And then look at gerrymandering today. Neighborhoods are still highly segregated in this nation. And so those soldiers felt that they had to fight. The reason America told them to fighting against communism. But in their hearts and souls, those black soldiers said, I'm fighting so mama can go vote. I'm fighting so that this nation deserves the honor, the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence, which this nation has never fully endorsed. But that's why those soldiers were there. It was a two-pronged mission. To tell the military that I'm fighting over here during my year-long year of duty, but when I get back to the States, you better not mess with me or my mama or my daddy or my aunt or my niece or my nephew. And that's what scared America, that everybody black who went to the military was trained how to use a gun, how to defend their communities. Thus, the Tulsa race riot in 1921, those who rose up to defend blacks who were slaughtered were mostly former soldiers who had volunteered to go to France, but they came back with skills. You are not going to lay down and watch your community die.
That was a powerful answer, which is a good segue to my next question. You told this story in a unique literary fashion. You told it through the eyes of nine distinct individuals. Now, time won't permit us to talk about the stories of each of those individuals, but you have the opportunity to buy the book and read it. But there are three whose stories were so compelling that we have to talk about them. And the first, and perhaps most important, is Maud DeVicta, a Veterans Administration employee. Tell us about her fight to discover the truth behind Agent Orange and how she sparked a movement to get relief from those soldier victims of Agent Orange.
Yes, Maud DeVicta worked out of the Chicago Veterans Administration office. Soldiers, black, white, Hispanic, Native American, started coming to her, telling her, I have soreness in my back. My vision is suffering. There's a hearing loss. And she traced it to a chemicals that were being sprayed. The U.S. sprayed chemicals so that the treetops and the leaves on the trees would fall off so that they could see the enemy better. And some of the soldiers thought that Agent Orange was orange crush soda. So they would come outside their tent and see these droplets coming down, and they would stick their tongue out so that they could get coolness, that they thought it was a soft drink. They thought it was orange crush, but it wasn't. It was chemicals that could kill foliage. And so Maud DeVictor said, something is amiss. And she started calling chemical companies saying, hey, what did Monsanto put in those barrels that were shipped over to Vietnam? And she found a whistleblower who told her what it was, deadly chemicals. Now, those chemicals were sprayed most heavily where? On the front lines. Who disproportionately was on the front lines? Black soldiers. So black soldiers thought Miss Maud DeVictor was black, thought that she would understand or listen to them because nobody else had listened to them. And the VA told her to shut down this probing that she was doing. They got mad at her, and eventually they drove her out of the VA. Of course, that lawsuit is still going on, many, many layers of it. And some of the soldiers got money, but not nearly enough, because some of their wives would have children, and the little baby would have two fingers missing. All that from Agent Orange.
Let's talk about Joe Anderson. He was an officer and a gentleman, a West Point grad, and was the subject matter of the Oscar-winning documentary, The Anderson Platoon, which was produced by French journalist Pierre Schoendoffer. How did that documentary come to be? And tell us about the irony of a French journalist having produced this documentary about an African-American soldier.
Yes, I'm so proud that I found Joe Anderson. Listen to this little fact. Joe Anderson was in grade school in Topeka, Kansas, with Linda Brown. The plaintiff in Thurgood Marshall in the NAACP's case, Brown v. Board of Education. Just imagine that. When he told me that, I just knew I was going to make Joe Anderson that he was going to have a whole chapter in this book. But he went to West Point, and he lands in Vietnam. And the first day he gets there, there's a fellow officer who tells him, says, sir, you can just lay low. These men love me as their leader. It was a white officer. And Joe Anderson walked over to him and said, move out of the way. This is my command now. I said, go on, Joe. You know, this is my command now. But the fact that the officer would tell a West Point graduate that is appalling. It just is.
You're listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. This week, what did freedom mean for Black Americans asked to fight for their country in Vietnam while still being denied equality at home? Acclaimed author and Columbus native Will Haygood explores the lasting echoes of a war that exposed America's deepest contradictions. Joining us this week, Will Haygood, journalist, professor, and author of the new bestseller, The War Within a War, The Black Struggle in Vietnam and at Home. Your host is Algernon Marbley, U.S. District Judge with the Southern District of Ohio. We'll get back to this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, The War Within a War, Will Haygood on race, Vietnam, and America's reckoning, after a short break.
Do you love amazing stories? I know I do. I'm Michael Kent, and every week on my show, we examine something from history that's so unbelievable it sounds made up, but is 100% verifiably true. It's a podcast called The Internet Says It's True, and there are hundreds of episodes to choose from. For example, did you know the story of how Leonard Nimoy came up with Live Long and Prosper for Star Trek? Or how Colombia is dealing with a hippo problem that goes back directly to Pablo Escobar? Or one of my favorite stories, a man figured out that a nondescript Winnebago being auctioned online was actually an important part of space exploration history. These are all stories from The Internet Says It's True. Listening to a podcast has never been easier. You can listen through any popular podcast app, through the NPR app, or download the fantastic new WCBE app, click the Podcasts tab, and look for The Internet Says It's True with Michael Kent. You'll have so many stories up your sleeve, you'll feel like the smartest person in the room, especially if you're home alone.
Hi there, this is Morgan James. Every album represents a step in an artist's journey. Hello, music lovers. I'm inviting you to listen to Music Journeys with Mike Foley. Mike mixes music and conversation with artists to share what informed and inspired their latest project, how the love of music began, what music means to them, and so much more. We've chatted about three of my projects, the most recent being Soul Remains the Same, a soul album of songs you would never expect. You can always expect the perfect combination of music and stories on Music Journeys. The show airs Saturday afternoons at 3:30 on WCBE. Recent episodes are available on the major podcast platforms and the WCBE app. To meet and hear more from all the musicians featured since its start in 2018, including me, to be the first to be featured three times on the show, look for Music Journeys on WCBE's podcast experience at WCBE.org.
Welcome back to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. This week, what did freedom mean for Black Americans asked to fight for their country in Vietnam while still being denied equality at home? Acclaimed author and Columbus native Will Haygood explores the lasting echoes of a war that exposed America's deepest contradictions. Joining us today, Will Haygood, journalist, professor, and author of the new bestseller, The War Within a War, The Black Struggle in Vietnam and at Home. Your host is Algernon Marbley, U.S. District Judge with the Southern District of Ohio. Let's get back to this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, The War Within a War, Will Haygood on Race, Vietnam, and America's Reckoning.
Joe Anderson was given orders to go up and rescue a troop of men who had been trapped, and he did, and he brought them all back successfully, those who were still living. And a French filmmaker heard about it and said, "Mr. Anderson, can I go on your next mission with you?" And he said, "Yes, as long as it's okay with the U.S. military." Now there were other in American documentary filmmakers over there, but none thought to ask the black Joe Anderson if they could go with him, because that would have meant that a film would come out and John Wayne, the mythical John Wayne, wouldn't be the hero of that film. It would be a black man. But the French, of course, had accepted black people into their world way before the USA did. Thus, James Baldwin went to live in Paris, and he died in France. Hell, things keep going the way they are in this country. Y'all might have to come to Paris and see me. Visit Will Haygood. Will lives on the left bank. He got tired. Will's kicking it on the left bank in Paris, y'all. Nous avons parlé français.
Before we get, I'm giving a signal that we have one more question, but I'm going to ask those of you in the audience who have questions to start making your way to the mic. You see Doug Buchanan, our communications director, over there, so you can start making your way over there. And for those of you who are joining us online, you can drop a question in the chat room and Doug will get it. So, all right. So the war had its impact on the arts community as well. The black arts community certainly was impacted. How significant was Motown's response in creating its own label, the Black Forum label, to accommodate the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, and Motown producing that seminal work, What's Going On?
Yes. One of the things that happened in the war, aside from the blood and the guts and the death and the dying, was that it was the first war where we saw photographs in newspapers of black and white soldiers together. It wasn't your grandfather's war. This was a visual war where we were able to see black and white troops. And that was in its own way, you know, the nation moving ahead. Also, there was culture. There was a seminal album, What's Going On, by Marvin Gaye that came out in 1971. And I had uttered a few lines of that seminal song, and my niece saw me, my sister saw me on some news program, and she said, "I never want you to mangle Marvin Gaye's words again." And so the lyrics, the song. And so this is my American Idol moment. Y'all can't go anywhere. You are captured, so you have to listen to me. Mind you, I am the un-Marvin Marvin Gaye, but here goes. Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see, oh, what's going on? What's going on? Thank you.
So I'll kick it to you now, Doug, now that we've treated the audience to his maiden voyage, his maiden verbal, you know, singing voyage.
Thank you, Judge Marbley. And Will, thank you so much. That might be a CMC first, at least a first in a while, so thank you. If you have a question for Will, please do join us here at the microphone. And if you're, as Judge Marbley mentioned, if you're watching online, type your question in the chat. We already have a nice line here. We'll try to get to as many questions as we can. Please do keep your questions short. Great questions at CMC can be asked in just a couple of sentences. And questions always end with a certain punctuation mark. What punctuation mark does a question end with always?
Question mark.
Hey, end with question marks. Law, you're up.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you both for being here. Mr. Will Haygood, thank you, first of all, for writing this book. I have several uncles who were drafted and went to Vietnam and came back with a lot of problems, including drug addiction and alcohol addiction. But as we see what's happening in the world right now, where we're back in war, whether we want to call it war or not, we're back in war, and there's been talk about a potential draft coming back again. How do we, as people, how do we stand up and say no? I mean, how do we fight what is happening right now so that we can protect our folks from going to a senseless war while we're still also battling a war here?
Yes, I have been, I'm on a national book tour for this book, and I visited probably seven colleges thus far, and I've been talking to high school students around the country. I talked to some high school students here this morning, and students are worried because they were the age of Skip Dunn. So we went to the polls in America and we elected a convicted criminal, a white man, over a very gifted black Asian woman. That told the world almost everything that it needed to be told about this nation. That's who we sent back to the White House. And now the country is suffering. The Trump administration banned one of my books, my colorization book. It was banned at the U.S. Naval Academy. And the Wall Street Journal, no liberal newspaper, wrote this line: Surely, Will Haygood's book on the history of black film is no threat to national security. I joined a long list of writers who have had books banned in this nation, James Baldwin and Toni Morrison, and John Steinbeck, and Hemingway. Not that I'm in their league, but I'm just making a point that when a nation bans books, it bans knowledge. And how do we fight back? Well, at the polls. That's how America was formed. People have to vote. They have to vote with intelligence. I know there are probably MAGA voters in this room, but you've been given a gift, America. Everybody can vote. Everybody can have an opinion. But when you are wrong, and when you witness a mob that's 99.9% white assault the Capitol, I think there were three black people there who got lost on the way to McDonald's. But you really have to know who you're voting for in this country, because as President Obama said, elections have consequences. So that's what we have to do. And it was one of the founding fathers who said, it is a democracy if you can keep it. Their exact words were, it is a republic if you can keep it. So it's still very, very debatable if we can keep the form of government that we have had going on 250 years.
Good afternoon. When I was reading your book, one thing that stood out to me was Soul Alley and how Vietnamese people like took in black soldiers. In your research, did anything stand out to you with how they were treating black soldiers, taking care of their hair, and embracing them, opposed to how the U.S. was treating them during that time?
Yes. Yes, that is a great question. Soul Alley was a seven-block long area in Vietnam that the black troops went over there and asked merchants, South Vietnamese merchants, hey, can you put things that we need in our culture, in your stores, in your shops, like a certain comb to comb our afro, certain foods we like, sweet potato pie, peach cobbler. I'm starting to get hungry. You know, just respect our culture. And so the Vietnamese merchants did it. And it was, you know, this street called Soul Alley. But one thing, like, how did the racism land in Vietnam? We transported it. American soldiers from the Citadel or VMI or Mississippi or Alabama or St. Louis or Columbus, they took the racism over there. James Baldwin said it, a racist society can't but help fight a racist war. And so that was evident that the black soldier came up against racism from the Vietnamese as well, because it had been transported over there. We had flown it and landed it in their country. And so that was a great question. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Fox with Community Strategy Partners. Mr. Haygood, you're also a journalist in addition to being a book author and professor. As a journalist, how do you feel the way journalism is being treated today in this country? What can we all do to help change those circumstances?
Yes, okay. You know, I still have to get used to being called Professor Haygood. I graduated with a 2.2. That's summa cum lucky. But it has been fun teaching. And of course, I worked many years at the Washington Post, and you all have heard what's happened to the paper. You know, dozens of my friends have been laid off. And they certainly won't get those jobs back. We have billionaires in this country who are really starting to exert their power. They tend not to like newspapers. We have seen newspapers die in this country. That's sad. That goes right along with the banning of books. I am astonished that we are where we are at as a nation. And I plead with voters to regain their sense of pride in the country. Because one thing this administration has shown us is that there are forces in this country that are anti-black forces, and they have muscle. Some of the veterans who I've interviewed in this book have called me with tears in their eyes. One veteran who I met at a reading, he had my book, and he walked up to the microphone at the end of my reading, and he held the book up, and he said, "Will, this book is causing me trauma, because I was in Vietnam, but it's also healing me, because I no longer want my story hidden." He said, "Hidden," and so. They're trying to erase history. Trump and his crew have knocked down markers that have shown black heroic movements in this country. And we've seen the people in Europe say, we aren't doing that. We have black historical markers in Amsterdam, in Switzerland, in England, and they stay up. They stay up because facts are facts. Let America screw around with its history, but we've got more sense than that over here in Europe. And it just angers me that this has been allowed to happen. I've been to these campuses, and there are no more DEI programs. They've been abolished, slashed. OSU right here no longer has a DEI office. That's appalling. That is appalling. What if somebody coming out of that DEI program has a cure for cancer? I mean, it's so illogical. Martin Luther King Jr. said, when I talk about racism, I'm talking to white people. That's what Martin Luther King Jr. said. And so, Nelson Mandela, who I watched walk out of prison. I was in South Africa on the morning Nelson Mandela walked out of prison. And what did he immediately do? He said, there will be no revenge against white people, but there will be the formulation of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We will talk about apartheid. We will talk about what happened. We will talk about the abuses. And now comes word that we don't need to teach slavery in high school because it's too fragile for the white kids. Really? What about the slaves who went through it? Please, give me a break. Okay, and so we had better find a way to stitch this nation back together, or else, and that is the truth. I mean, I have been a foreign correspondent. I have seen democracies fall right before my eyes. I've seen democracies fall. I've seen foreign capitals get attacked successfully, and a government falls the next day. And so, you know, if we go la-di-la-di-la-di-da into the future, there will be a heavy price to pay. Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Haygood.
Hello.
My name is Bethany Ellis. I am a superintendent student ambassador of Columbus City Schools. I'm a high schooler. Teenagers in particular are often observant and soak up information like sponges, trying to take the experience of others as a chance to learn, similar to what you did in your book. So I ask you, what lesson in regards to your book would you want students my age to pay attention to the most? And what information do you hope that us high school students take with us into adulthood as we read your books?
Yes. Super question. This is what I hope you would carry, and that's a super question. War is hell. It is. I was in Somalia. Some of my people here know this. Larry James and his wife, Donna James, they know this because I've sat at their kitchen table, and I reminisced about how many times I have been in harm's way. And I was taken hostage in Somalia. Rescued, thankfully, but war is hell. And it's hell not on the people who move the troops around, but on the people who do the fighting. And who does the fighting? The 18 and 19 and 20 and 21 year olds. And so when six of my neighbors were taken out of North Fifth Street and sent to the war, our community was dense. Was truly devastated, because you look at teenage boys, they usually are the ones who goes to the swimming pool to walk their sisters back home, or they go to the bus stop to pick their moms up at 9 o'clock at night when they're getting off work. Our communities were decimated by the Vietnam War. And so I want students to realize that we shouldn't use war heroism as a means to put somebody in the White House. We don't have to always say, they fought in the war and killed a lot of people, so they would be smart to send to the White House. And then I don't know what trick Trump used, but he never went to war, never went to the military. He maligned the military, and he still gets elected. Can you imagine if Obama had done that? I mean, he would have been run out of this country on rails. And yet, it was the element of white supremacy that smoothed the pathway for Trump to get elected not once, but twice. And he started a war. And I'm in Washington, D.C. About four dozen of my friends have lost jobs at the Smithsonian, at other arts institutions. This is a travesty. This really is. I just don't know how to put it. But people who vote, young people, have rallies. There's a No Kings rally, I know, this Saturday, all across the country. We do not want a king in the White House. The nation will not survive.
Thank you very much, Will, to end on that powerful note is altogether fitting and appropriate. Doug has given me the we're done sign, and I'm going to bring back Sophia to wrap up for us.
You've been listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. This week, we explored what freedom meant for Black Americans asked to fight for their country in Vietnam while still being denied equality at home. Our special guest was journalist, professor, best-selling author, and Columbus native Will Haygood. His new book is The War Within a War, The Black Struggle in Vietnam and at Home. Your host was Judge Algernon Marbley with the Southern District of Ohio. This forum was sponsored by Bricker Graydon Wyatt, Larry and Donna James, and the Robert Weiler Company. The presenting sponsor of our live stream was the Center for Human Kindness at the Columbus Foundation. The Columbus Dispatch was our live stream partner. Additional support was provided by Downtown Columbus Incorporated and the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. If you finish Will Haygood's new book and you'd like to keep exploring this week's forum topic, our friends at the Columbus Metropolitan Library also recommend reading Until the Last Gun is Silent by Matthew Delmont. Join us next week as the not-for-profit Columbus Metropolitan Club once again connects people and ideas through community conversations. I hope you'll join us. I'm Doug Buchanan. Thanks for listening.